Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Well, thousands of novels flood the American bookstores every year, tens of thousands maybe, and we think the novels that we read and enjoy have been with us forever. We do that until somebody like Phil Gura, professor of American literature and culture at Carolina, comes along and writes a book like Truth's Ragged Edge, The Rise of the American Novel. There's history to it. It wasn't always with us. And the history is kind of interesting the way he tells it in his book. And so I've asked him if he would join us and share with us some of the stories about the history of the novel. What about the novel? I mean, Don Quixote, novels have been with us.
They have. They've been with us in Western culture for a very long time. But in fact, this book covers the period from 1789 to the early 1870s. And 1789 really is the year of the first novel published in what became the United States of America. So we have a little lag time in between. And in England, if you're studying the English fiction, 1740s and 50s is the time when the novel arises. So the form of telling stories is nothing new, but putting it into certain kinds of generic patterns, publishing it in a form in which many people can read it instead of singing it as a song, as Homer might have. These things really were new in the 18th century, in the early 19th century. And what I try to show in this book really is, as you just suggested, the close connection to the fact that history mattered to these people in a way it doesn't to many of our fiction writers today. Certainly anybody today writing is formed by his time, but in the 1820s or 30s or 40s, authors really had the sense they were part of a public conversation about very important things. And one of the ones I trace most clearly in this book is the matter of religious concerns, which were very large to these individuals. So this book really makes a survey of what we consider the early American novel from the late 18th century through the period just after the Civil War. I stop there because the Civil War does begin to change things. It takes a while for people to assimilate the horror, the size of monstrosity of the Civil War. I don't do any novels that really treat that, and we don't have any good ones until later in the 19th and early 20th century. So this is, in a sense, we don't have any good novels that treat the American Civil War. In other words, we don't have a good novel, or really not many novels at all, by people who went through the war as soldiers. Stephen Crane, The Red Badge of Courage, he was not in the war. That's from his imagination. So we have people like Mark Twain or Henry James or William Dean Howells who could have been in the war and either weren't, or if they were in Mark Twain's case for a brief time,
on the Confederate side, they
chose not to write about these things. And in the case of people like Howells and James, who wrote 20, 30 novels apiece, it's really quite remarkable. Daniel Aaron, one of my mentors a long time ago, wrote a book called The Unwritten War, which is about the fact that poets and fiction writers seem to have a hard time dealing with that.
Sort of. I mean, it's at least we're not following the outline of your book. We're getting ahead of the game in terms – but maybe more important even than your book is this thing that you're raising with us right now, which is we didn't – I mean, this Civil War that we had, the people who participated in it didn't write fiction about it to describe its horror. We had to wait for later generations using their imagination and their research skills to write about this.
Sure. And if you think about it, it takes 10 or 15 years after a very important conflict before you can have the kind of looking back and making sense of that will move people, particularly if you're trying to write a very high-end work of fiction. I mean, we're just getting books. We're still getting books about the Vietnam War now that are highly praised. And that, look how far back that is. It'll take a while before we get really interesting novels about Afghanistan. It'll be 10 or 15 years, I think, before that occurs. We can have memoirs and things, but if you're talking about someone who makes a profession as a writer who's thinking about the complexity of the situation, wanting to encompass it in certain ways, it takes a certain amount of reflection.
Well, moving back to the early period that you cover in your book about the history of the American novel, what did they write about in 1789 and forward? What kinds of things?
Well, one of the earliest generic conventions was what we find in books like Hannah Foster's The Coquette, Mary Rowson's The Charlotte Temple, and others. That is about the temptations young women faced, particularly from rakes, from men who had designs on them, and they're trying to resist these kinds of overtures, trying to, in a sense, assert their moral purity in the face of these kinds of challenges to it. In other words, what you might call a kind of sentimental tale of the woman who is being somehow attacked or chased by someone. Very quickly, though, this is a convention that we find in England as well. Very quickly, we move to novels that have a base more in early American history. And these are particularly interesting because if you think about it, that period is one in which people are trying to write something new, to write something that really pertains to America alone. You can have a seduction novel set in London. You can have one set in Paris. You can't have a novel about the American Revolution set in London. It's got to be set where it was happening. So many writers like James Fenimore Cooper, like in the South, William Gilmore Sims, and one of the ones I resurrect, Catherine Sedgwick, in the Northeast, were writing early historical fiction, not only to present what they considered the facts of these early American books, but also to preserve what they considered the kinds of virtues that had made the generations who fought in that war worthy of our praise in later years.
Well, I want to go back to the beginning, and I just tell you, I was bowled over by the prominence of sex in the sense of seduction,
mm-hmm.
and the risk or the risk of seduction for young women. And it looked like all of them were getting into trouble with the worst kinds of men. And what was, I mean,
well, listen, these many of these novels, not all, but many of them, in fact, were written by women. And they're very interesting for that fact in particular, because let's take Hannah Foster's The Coquette. It's about a very attractive Foster's Coquette.
You say this is the first bestseller.
Well, that's right. In other words, these are books that went through several reprintings. In other words, they didn't come out once in 250 or 400 copies and then simply die to be resurrected by scholars. Books like The Coquette, books like Charlotte Temple really went through multiple editions in different years from different places. Now, we're still not talking about 40 or 50,000 books, but we're talking about enough of an interest by the public to warrant this kind of republication. In that book, a young woman very attractive, has a proposal of marriage from a very worthy catch, that is, a young minister who's going to have a very important parish. But she doesn't feel that she's ready for marriage yet. She doesn't dislike the person. She knows the importance of making a good match, but she just feels as though she's enjoying her freedom, her going to different cotillions, her going to teas too much. And in that period, while she's holding him off, another gent comes in and begins to take an interest in her. And she then has to juggle these two individuals, knowing that the right one indeed is the first, but really enjoying the kinds of attention she's receiving from the second. Well, the trouble is that the first man, the minister, gets jealous and finally gives her an ultimatum. And in a very interesting scene in which she really was going to reject number two, but they're being so close together in conversation, they're looking so intimate, number one thinks they are being intimate, number one throws her over and decides that she couldn't be the kind of woman who would be worth a minister's time. Well, then the man who decides that he has wanted to chase her place her a little more, leaves for a few months, leaves actually for about a year, making her pine over him. And she's left as someone who doesn't have any immediate prospects. In that kind of society, when you begin to make those kinds of mistakes about men, you get a reputation. And what happens is over a course of years, she finally realizes that no one else is going to give her any kind of courtship. She has to return. When her suitor number two returns, she has to return to him, and before long, he actually has seduced her. He's gotten her pregnant, And once this is discovered by her family and friends, she is taken off to a tavern where she dies shortly after childbirth.
And the moral?
So the immediate moral is that she should have married that number one very early on. But the more interesting suggestion is there are no other kinds of things women can do. They can't play the field. They can't exercise their freedom. They're going to be trapped in these situations. Thus, they should try to be more moral people, even though they're, in a sense, bristling against these strictures. So it's a confused message. She's very appealing. She's not in any sense a prostitute or someone of ill repute. She's very nice, but she's not allowed to grow up the way she wants. She's forced into certain kinds of role models. So a young woman reading this in the early 1800s is not only identifying with that tragic end, but identifying with those kinds of fetters that have been put around her.
Who would read this book?
Oh, I suspect this particular book would be read more by young women, indeed. Another fascinating thing, D.G., this is a time when you have the rise of a much larger reading public. What do I mean by that? In 1750, there wasn't much spare time for people. If you had a farm, farming occupied most of your time, different seasons, different work. If you had a store or if you were a minister, you still had to have your small farm on the side for produce. Once we start having industrialization, once we start having mechanization, once things are made in factories, that frees a lot of time, particularly for women who before had to do spinning, weaving, making of clothing. All of that now is done by factory work, and that allows people to use this new thing called leisure in different ways. They might join a home missionary society and make clothing for indigent people. They might join a temperance society and go to meetings and advocate against drinking. They might sit at home and read the latest novel that comes out. So again, this notion of finally this being an activity that really is something with which you can occupy your time in a new way for instruction purportedly, but also more and more, in a sense, for a kind of expansion of your mind. That's what's fascinating about these people. You found novels published on all sorts of topics. People could learn about so many different kinds of things in 1830 than they could in 1730. Wow.
I'm going to interrupt you because
yes.
We need to take a quick break. But Phil Gurr and I are talking about his new book. It's called Truth's Ragged Edge, The Rise of the American Novel. He and I will be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin, and we're visiting with Phil Gurr. He's a professor of American literature and culture at Carolina and the author of a brand new book. It's called Truth's Ragged Edge, The Rise of the American Novel. Phil, this is fascinating to me, and you were talking about a book that interested me, The Coquette, because it was based, as several of these books are, something that happened really.
I mean, yes, that's right. In other words, by this time, you also have, in most larger cities, at least weekly papers, not quite dailies yet, but weekly papers, and certain kinds of events would be reported, not only news from abroad or from the capitals, but also local news that would be of interest to people. And the Coquette is, in fact, based on the story of a woman named Elizabeth Whitman, who really had experiences very similar to this. And the mystery with Elizabeth Whitman was that we don't really know who that cad was, that it never has been ascertained beyond doubt who is the one who got her pregnant. She literally died in a tavern in Danvers, Massachusetts, shortly after giving childbirth. And Foster took that story, embroidered it, but clearly people knew she was talking about a current event. So again, it's much like a fiction writer today who would take some kind of spectacular case, whether it was a legal case, whether it was something that happened in wartime, whatever, and made it the basis for a meditation on various kinds of things.
Yeah, because, I mean, like just in our local newspapers, you're reading about these murders of wives or murders of husbands and Murders by friends.
It doesn't have to be simply that. It could be, for example, if you were following political news, it might be the sit-ins at the legislature in Raleigh and examining the people's motives and making a novel about, you know, the challenge to what's happening in state government. You could take any current event and begin to work with it as a novelist if you have the right kind of imagination. And again, I use that example because during that period, politics, religion, philosophy, all these things were on the table. I have a section you remember about the new environment of the mill village, factories. People were writing fiction about factories because nobody had worked in factories before.
Tell us about this. This is, and I apologize for interrupting you, but this is real. Was real important to me is that you, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I want you to talk more about it, but that basically you had two different kinds of America, the one right after the Revolution and then as the Industrial Revolution came about and there were factories – The literature moved into a different environment and had to deal with these things. And what difference did it make?
Well, there were two environments, D.G. One, and I'll come right back to it, is in fact this industrial environment. And the other is the city environment, the urban environment. I see you have a copy of an old literary anthology here. The trajectory of fiction as it had been taught for many years when you and I went to college – essentially was that of the best novels were written about men alone challenging the wilderness in some way. That is James Fenimore Cooper's The Deer Slayer, Melville's Ishmael on the Open Sea, Huck Finn lighting out for the territories at the end of Huckleberry Finn. And we were taught that these authors took this notion of man against that aloneness, that special environment as the archetype of American fiction. Well, a lot more people experience something like the urban environment or the factory environment than they did that environment of the wilderness that Cooper describes. In other words, most people were going to remain back in the East. Most people were going to make a living by working in a factory, by going into a city and working in a cabinet shop for the first time on mechanized saws or whatever it might be. So these fiction writers were fascinated by what that meant for one's development. Now, let's take the factory. The factory was an incredibly complex new environment, large-sized buildings, noise all day long, what we would call environmental hazards, lint and dust everywhere being chopped up by these machines that were spinning or weaving. The descriptions of just that kind of physical space are really quite amazing and quite frightening. We wouldn't put up with that now. But further, the people working there constituted a new kind of class. They were what we would call a working class in a new way. They were wage laborers. They got paid so much by the hour. They worked 10 or 12-hour days. They were held in check or held in their positions by overseers, another class above them. So these novelists began to realize that we had, in a sense, this kind of incipient class system developing and that there was room for abuses by different people in different positions.
Have you got an example of a book?
Well, there's a wonderful one called A Book Without a Name. Interesting title, and its subtitle has to do with the main character. It's the story of Mira Dana, about a young woman who comes from the woods of New Hampshire and begins to work in the famous Lowell Mills. And what makes this novel fascinating is that Mira becomes an organizer or leader of one of the first walkouts or strikes.
She's a striker.
Recorded in fiction, in American fiction.
Is that right?
This
because
is in the
well,
early
1850s. This is an extraordinary woman, as described it. You'd think that a woman taking a leadership in
and this novel has simply been off the radar for 150 years.
Was it popular
years.
When it was? Was it popular?
Not in the sense that we saw the coquette or those, but it was published in Worcester, republished in Boston a year or so later. And really, it is fascinating not only because of its presentation of that factory town, but also because, as we say, we have a woman here who has emerged as someone who understands that the problem of labor affects women the same as men. So fascinating. And one can find other things like this. With regard to the city, probably the most fascinating book talked about is this one called The Quaker City by George Lepard. About the Quaker City, of course, is Philadelphia. And Lepard's book is an expose of the kinds of sin, the kinds of evil, the kinds of crime practiced by the upper classes of Philadelphia once nighttime falls.
Yeah, what about this? There's a section. Is there a building?
Or there's a building. One of the subtitles is The Monks of Monk Hall. And the monks are these supposedly good Christian men who do business all day long as attorneys or business people or bankers. And at night they go to Monk Hall, which is a very, to my mind, is kind of a huge Victorian-type building with different levels and trapdoors and things. And it's essentially a place where they bring young women, where they seduce them, where they get drunk, where all kinds of hideous things occur.
This is just imagination, isn't it?
This was the time, again, in New York, in Philadelphia, in large cities, when the exclusive clubs were coming into existence. We hear about the Cosmos Club or something like that today. The Algonquin Club in New York. These kinds of places for men began to arise in the urban environments in the 1850s and 60s.
Well, there might
as getaways, as private places. Well, and again, as you may recall, this is another one of those novels that has at least one of its subtexts as based on a story that was appearing in
another
the newspapers.
Seduction,
yes,
and
another
story.
Seduction. Now, again, this is not to say that although you want it to move in that direction, that the novels are most interesting because they problematize sex in these ways. I think we should talk at some point about the ways that these were recasting religious matters.
Let's do
as
that.
Well.
Let's take a break.
Good.
And we'll come back and we'll get off of sex and murder and seduction, and we'll talk about the changing religious views that are represented by these novels that Phil Gura talks about in his new book, Truth's Ragged Edge. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin, and I'm visiting with Professor Phil Gura of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, where he teaches American literature and culture. His new book is called Truth's Ragged Edge, The Rise of the American Novel. We're not going to get all the way through your book, but, boy, some of these books that you found. Let me ask you, Phil, my question. You know, you mentioned earlier that I brought in a survey anthology of American literature for use in teaching, I guess, American literature in the university. And of all of these people in the pre-Civil War period, you mention a lot of books and a lot of authors. Some of them are very important for one reason or another. And I mean, other than poetry, about James Fenimore Cooper is about all you find in this arena.
One of the purposes of my work was to challenge the way we think about that period, the way we think of the literature in that period, and also more long term to make people realize that there are other kinds of things that should be included in anthologies. That doesn't happen overnight; it's a slow process. But let me just explain what I was doing and how I did it. There, over the course of years, people create what are called bibliographies on different topics. That is, you assess all the books that are written about, let's say, the study of ornithology, bird life in the antebellum period, whatever. Well, people have done that. They've listed, in going to our large libraries, all of the American fiction published between 1789 and, let's say, 1850. If I were to ask you, an educated person, to name five novelists from that period, you could probably, but you probably couldn't name 10, and you certainly couldn't name 20. Well, there were, as we were saying earlier, almost 2,000 novels published in that period by what these bibliographers have established. So what I said to myself was, well, you know, we're reading 5, 8, 10 of these. What else is there? How can we assess this? Well, I didn't read all of those novels, but you're quite right. I read certainly in the hundreds of them. And I tried to make my selection by looking at the different journals and newspapers of that period that, in fact, were beginning to do book reviews. It may sound like something we do in the 20th century, but the actual job of book reviewing was begun in that period. People like Edgar Allan Poe, for example, made a lot of money reviewing books. Margaret Fuller, another important intellectual, did that. So I surveyed certain journals, certain newspapers in the larger cities, and got a sense of what people were talking about, what people thought were important. And yes, Cooper would be there. There's no denying Cooper was important. But if you're thinking of people who are sort of going off in new directions, investigating new subjects, there were scores and even, you know, maybe even a couple hundred of people who were fascinating. So if you treat this as cultural history, not all of these are novels that you're going to not put down at your bedside. Some of them are, to their credit. But you're certainly going to read these with a very pleased reaction if you're interested in learning about the cultural history of the period. So what I tried to do was to get a handle on what the main concerns were of these novels. We mentioned this topic, let's say, of how gender relations figured, but even of more importance was the way they were thinking about the formation of character. These weren't so much instructive books, but they were books that you read to reflect on about your own situation in life, about your own dealings with your fellow beings. That's what makes them fascinating. So let me give you an example. Let's say I've read 150 books, and I've read them between 1790 and 1850. I'm looking for a line. I'm looking for a way of thinking about how I can organize them. This is one of the ways that occurred to me. In the earliest fiction, what we have is a person who thinks about him or herself in terms of an immortal soul. You are that thing. You are that from creation. You have a certain constitution that God has given you. And your life, in a sense, is a reflection of what you are on the inside. By the 1820s or 30s, that notion of what you were begins to change. And what you really start seeing is people thinking of each other in terms not so much of a soul, but of one's character. What does that mean? Character is something that is made for you by your own moral actions, your moral behavior. It is something, in a sense, you model your character on certain people. You might model yourself on Benjamin Franklin. You might model yourself on George Washington. You want to have a character like his. You want to have his virtues. So you're taking into your self-definition the attributes of people you admire. And, of course, many people would put on the top of that list Jesus Christ. We want to be good Christian characters. Then the most fascinating shift occurs in the 1850s with people like Melville, with people like this woman, Elizabeth Stoddard, whom I discuss. The movement is we are personalities. I am a personality. I am a unique thing. I have a certain kind of sensibility that is all my own, and that's what makes me of interest. That's what makes Ahab of interest. So I can circle novels around these three very interesting religious poles.
And this moves into your, I guess it relates to your study of the transcendentalist
Sounds
like Emerson a little bit.
It does. The other large contribution here is that, as in that book on the transcendentalists, I do see the main cultural conflict in these years as that between whether one should have allegiance to self, to one's self-interest, to one's success as an individual, or whether oneself should be subordinated to the commonwealth, to the common good. In other words, to make yourself more outer-directed. And really, when I spoke a moment ago about personality, though many of those writers were creating that kind of inward-looking, self-centered person, the person absorbed in his own mind or her own mind. And how I end the book, as you may remember, is by the late 60s and 70s, I begin to see people again who are calling people back to some other larger sense of their relation to the community. A woman named Elizabeth Stuart Phelps, Rebecca Harding Davis, who wrote Life in the Iron Mills, people like this realize that hyper-individualism is a problem. And we live with this today. When I teach these books, I tell my students, you know, what I'm saying to you is what we see in our politics. We see some parties that represent at all costs, seemingly, the fulfillment of the individual. And we have others saying, no, we have responsibilities, be it through Social Security, be it through Medicare, whatever, to our community as a whole. And we're fighting about these things, you know, in our Congress as we speak. So this is deeply embedded in our American psyche, and it's very visible even in that pre-Civil War period.
Well, we're visiting with Phil Gura. We're talking about his new book, Truth's Ragged Edge, The History of the American Novel, and he and I will be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Phil Gura. He's a professor of American Literature and Culture at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And he's written a book called Truth's Ragged Edge, The Rise of the American Novel. And we're talking about all different kinds of things. Phil, I have to say that some of your descriptions of these books, you got carried away on some of them. You really liked some of them. It was quite clear. And so before we just launched, you've now read all these books, and you're a scholar, and we talked about the collections of what kids have to read if they're taking American literature. We've got our catalog or our canon of books. Did you find anything that's a candidate for the canon that you liked enough to say, you know, I would put this on my bookshelf and read, or is all of this just history?
That's a great question. I'll circle into it this way. What you're describing in a way is that the books that we continue to want to read somehow become larger for us, and we have been led to believe that is on aesthetic grounds. That is, that when one reads a book, it affects one in a very powerful way because of the way it is written. That kind of aesthetic concern, the sense that the form is very important, is not one that greatly concerned the people back in this period. They were much more interested in having their books be of a certain kind of utility to people. I was suggesting a few moments ago, for example, about the building of one's persona or one's character. So you take even a book like Moby Dick. That is not a book. That is a sprawling, unusual work. You wouldn't call that a tightly chiseled or closely honed novel. It's a novel bursting with ideas, and we love it. I think there are books like that that we can talk about from this period. On the other hand, if you take a writer like Hawthorne, there is a kind of elegance, there is a kind of precision of language and economy of language quite different from his friend Melville. And when we read The Scarlet Letter, we realize how much we're being channeled and controlled by this man's skill with the language. But he doesn't bubble with ideas. He doesn't bubble with possibilities in quite the same way as some of these other people. Mary Gove Nichols is one I will choose, and she wrote a novel called Mary Lyndon, Lyndon. And it is interesting. Among the most interesting novels I found were those by women primarily of the 1850s who were inheriting, in a sense, the early woman's movement, what you'd call the early feminist movement. They're beginning to think about their roles. They're beginning to wonder just what life has in store for them if they don't want a traditional life. If you're interested in thinking about your choices as a woman, even today, a book like Mary Lyndon, about a woman intellectual who finally chooses to live out of wedlock and have a child and write for sort of what you'd call the intelligentsia of the day, this is a fascinating object lesson for people back then as well as for ourselves. So you find women in the form of fiction breaking those molds that they're still having a difficult time with in their real lives. Oh, we haven't talked about this, DG. What about African American fiction of this period?
Well, before you do that, I want to go there. But on this book, Mary Lyndon, where you say she breaks away, the author breaks away from the idea of in some sort of religious teaching. She just says, "Go for it."
Indeed. She comes out of that sort of liberal transcendentalist tradition that you and I have talked about before. And again, if you're claiming men and women are equal, women should be able to do the same kinds of things as men, and that means in their personal lives as well. Because neither she or her husband think that marriage should be the kind of bond that it is, they choose not to get married, instead to have essentially an open family situation in the 1850s.
Great. Well, I apologize for interrupting you, because I do think it's important that you talk to us a little bit about the African-American novels and the novels about African-Americans.
Yes, and there aren't a lot of them. There aren't a lot of them in this period. African-American fiction really begins to take off, particularly after 1870 or so, because of there's a black periodical press. Many novels first get serialized in papers for the African-American community. But there were some published, and one or two in particular are quite striking. You asked which books I think should be there on our shelves. One of them should be a book by a man named Frank Webb named The Garys, G-A-R-I-E-S, The Garys, referring to a family. This is a book published before the Civil War about middle-class black life in Philadelphia. In other words, this isn't another slave narrative. This isn't another novel of someone getting whipped on a plantation. This is a novel about community of black people living in Philadelphia as essentially lower middle-class workers and feeling not the effects of slavery, but the effects of racial prejudice.
Yeah. And it's not a black –
it's
free black,
Frank Webb is a free black man. Now, the reason we haven't thought a lot about it is because, in fact, when Webb published it, he was living in London. It was published in London. But it's by an American. It's about an American city. And it's a very powerful example of what will concern African Americans after the Civil War and Reconstruction. That is, our problems are not over. They have to do with the way color is perceived. And Webb is right on this in the late 1850s. Equally fascinating, although not quite as compelling a read, but an important little book, Harriet Wilson writes a book called Our Nig. And Our Nig is the story of a black serving woman in New England. And she's the child of biracial parents. She's abused as a child. She's living in a home with white people who don't like her, who really treat her not as a slave, but as she's not enslaved, but she's essentially like an indentured servant. And Harriet Wilson tries to give you a sense of what's beneath this veneer of New England respectability about all these people who are into abolition and for our race. And yet when they come to treat our race directly, this is what they do to someone.
Abolitionist and racist.
That's right. Exactly.
Time.
Well, exactly. And not only that, but racist not only in thought, but very much in their behavior, in their deeds. So these are books that really open up the African-American experience in very exciting new ways for that period. We think of others, for example, Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl by Harriet Jacobs, but that's become more or less canonical now. But there are still others like these I mentioned that are important.
Well, you mentioned Harriet Jacobs, and of course she's a North Carolina native, so we maybe you can tell us a little bit more about her.
Well, she was born in the eastern part of the state, and to resist the attention of an older white man, she literally sequestered herself in her grandmother's home in an upper room of the home for years, literally just coming downstairs in the evenings or at nighttime so that she would not be discovered. And finally, after that, makes her way to the North and writes a very important novel about that situation of not only her experiences in the shadow of slavery around Wilmington in that region, but in fact also in the North as she tries to recover children that she's left in the South. So there's a richness there as well.
I hate to end our conversation. This is just great, but I'm glad we can end it on North Carolina a based note, but you've covered so nicely a lot of literature that I never heard of before and I'm interested in now. In your new book, Truth's Ragged Edge, The Rise of the American Novel. Our guest has been Phil Gura. Thanks to him for joining us.
Thank you, DJ.
Thanks to all y'all for listening, and I'll be back here before you know it.